This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I heard my first jazz concert when I was a little kid. The Ahmad Jamal Trio opened for Dizzy Gillespie and his big band, and I was hooked. For actor, singer, author, and dancer Molly Ringwald, that early introduction to jazz came practically while she was still in the womb. Her father is a jazz pianist, and by the time Molly was 3 years old, she was already belting out classic jazz standards and show tunes with her dad at the keyboard. Since then, Molly Ringwald has enjoyed a highly successful acting career, and recently, the mother of three has come full circle and released her debut album, titled Except Sometimes. The CD is filled with wonderful tunes from the great American songbook, like I'll Take Romance, Where Is Love, as well as a nice arrangement of the Simple Minds classic, Don't You Forget About Me.
Won't you come see about me? I'll be alone, dancing, you know, baby.
Molly and her pianist arranger Peter Smith will join the UNC at Greensboro Jazz Ensemble 1 Friday night, April 24th, for what's sure to be an exciting evening of big band and voice. Molly spoke with me by phone from her home in Los Angeles.
Don't you forget about me.
What's it been like getting back to singing, I mean, the Great American Songbook and really focusing, you know, a good bit of your energy on singing so intensely after being away for a while?
It's been really great. I mean, it's something I enjoy. It's not exactly something that I anticipated doing. I kind of just figured that I would do it as a little side project, but it kind of had its own momentum. And, you know, I've always just tried to follow things, you know, a little bit organically in my life and just kind of go in directions that I thought were interesting. And so, you know, what started out as this little thing kind of just snowballed from there, and it's really been great. I mean, it's been like a real education, and you know, half the time I end up feeling like why wasn't I doing this all along, you know? But then again, I was kind of busy doing other things.
Yeah.
But it's you know, I'm very fortunate to have incredible musicians who are very committed to playing with me, and you know, and I learned so much from them, and we just have a really great time together. I mean, I think that's really what it's about, is that we just really enjoy the music.
Speaking of the music, the very thought of you singing made me think of singing a beautiful slow ballad, like the very thought of you with lots of breaks in the melodic line and time mm-hmm. for piano feels along the way. How do you keep that pulse, that forward momentum going in that context?
How do I do it? I don't know. I you know, I've never taught a class or explained how I sing. It's just sort of like I open my mouth and I do it. I just do what feels natural and what feels appropriate to the song. That was actually the first arrangement that I heard from Peter Smith, who's the person that I've collaborated with for a while now. We met in New York City. Actually, Peter's an actor as well. But that was actually, I think, the first arrangement that I had heard him do for a singer was that song. And I really kind of loved the simplicity. It almost has a doo-wop line behind it.
And Peter's playing piano on that piece as well?
Yeah, Peter plays piano on all the pieces.
Yeah, sounds great.
And I forget to do a little ordinary things.
You really capture an element of wonder in your voice on that tune, a very intimate one-on-one sort of
yeah.
communication. What sorts of images come to mind when you're up there, say, performing this tune live to kind of get you there in that space?
You know, it depends. It's a little bit like acting in a way. I mean, I try to think of who is singing the song, whether it's me or whether it's somebody, you know, a character, a story, somebody from the past, somebody that I know. Very oftentimes when I sing that song, I think of my daughter. Each one of my children have their own song that's kind of like their song. And I have this picture of her dressed up as a flower when she was three years old. And for some reason, every time I sing that song, you know, I see her face in every flower. I just like picture her little face in this flower.
I see your face in every flower.
For me, just like in theater, you know, it makes every performance a little bit different because I don't always think about the same thing. Sometimes, you know, sometimes I even hear lyrics differently. You know, it'll be a lyric that I have sung over and over again, and all of a sudden it will click in a completely different way depending on what I'm thinking about.
That's interesting. Because I'm struck by the, I'm always struck by what translates in performance and, you know, from the performer, what you're thinking and how we feel it in the audience. And I was struck by the, and you're just a great storyteller and all these tunes. And I'm feeling like I'm, you know, in on your secret in some sense. Did that storytelling ability just come naturally to you? Does that relate back to the theater background anyway? How does that go?
Thank you, by the way. That's a very nice compliment. I do think I'm a natural storyteller, you know, and I think a certain amount of that comes from me as an actress, you know, conveying emotion, and also I'm a writer as well. So I do think in terms of, you know, the lyrics are very important to me and the story that they tell. So I think that they all sort of converge at some point, and you know, they all kind of influence each other in some way.
I get along without you very well, of course I do, except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves.
Except sometimes, this is such a gorgeous performance. I really enjoy that the lyrics to the song have always just torn me up just to read them on the page. I'm wondering how you hinted at it a little bit earlier, some of the imagery that comes up, but how do you convey that sense of sadness and keep it together just in performance? What sorts of things do you have to juggle?
I know, that's a really tricky, interesting and tricky thing to, you know, to be able to do. I've never been somebody who can have a lot of emotion and sing at the same time. You know, whenever I watch Anne Hathaway in Les Miserables, I keep thinking, how does she do that? She's crying and she's staying on pitch. It's amazing. Because for me, it's like one or the other. You know, so you really have to sort of calibrate. There are certain songs that I have to sing so much to where I'm able to calibrate the emotion. So the emotion is there, but it's not, you know, it's not there so much that I'm unable to sing. And I too find that song very, very moving, which is, I think, one of the reasons why I use Except Sometimes as a title track.
What a fool am I to think my breaking heart could kid the
Jazz vocalist, actor, author, and dancer Molly Ringwald. On Friday night, April 24th, she and her pianist Peter Smith will be in concert with the UNC at Greensboro Jazz Ensemble 1 and Strings. All proceeds go to the Greensboro Urban Ministry. The Miles Davis Festival concert begins at 8 p.m. in Acock Auditorium, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. If you've never heard the UNCG Jazz Ensembles under the leadership of folks like bassist Steve Haynes, saxophonist Chad Eby, and trumpeter Brandon Lee, these kids are smoking hot jazzers and accomplished improvisers. You will not be disappointed. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and we're going to take a short turn now from jazz to a blues-inspired play. In August Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone, his characters struggle openly with the intense discrimination Black Americans faced in the decades shortly after emancipation. The UNCG production will showcase Black perspectives as experienced in the year 1911 using integrated storytelling, movement choreography, and song. Although Wilson's stories reflect African-American experiences, Triad Stage Artistic Associate and UNCG Resident Director Tamira Islar says the themes in the play are universal. So central to this play, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, is the character Loomis. Tell me about Loomis.
In Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone, Harold Loomis represents one of the unfortunate men who were captured by Joe Turner for minor offenses. In his 7 years of forced labor, Mr. Loomis has forgotten his identity, his worth, and thus he has forgotten his song. There's an interesting quote by August Wilson that speaks more to this, if I could just read just a bit of that for you.
Yeah, sure.
In August Wilson's words, because the 7 years Loomis is with Joe Turner, 7 years in which his world is torn asunder and his life is turned upside down, can in fact represent the 400 years of slavery, of being taken out of Africa and brought to America. At some point, someone says, okay, you're free. What do you do? Who are you, first of all? And what do you do now that you're free? Which is Loomis's question. He says, I must reconnect and reassemble myself. But when he goes to the place where he lived, his life is no longer there. His wife and daughter aren't there. He is, in effect, a foreigner to the place. So he goes off on a search. He searches for a woman to say goodbye to and to find a world that contains his image. Because there's nothing about the world that he finds himself in that speaks to the thing that's beating inside his chest. And in the process of that search, he falls into an ancestral drove and is witness to bones rising up out the ocean, taking on flesh and walking up on the land. This is his connection with the ancestors, the Africans who were lost during the Middle Passage and were thrown overboard. He is privileged to witness this because he needs most to know who he is. It is telling him, this is who you are. You are these bones. You are the sons and daughters of these people. This is who you are. This is what Bynum tries to guide him toward. And the scene where Loomis reveals his vision can be read as a baptism, as a naming. Loomis's, he recognizes that his learning to sing his song and his acceptance of that is what makes him luminous. And that's, according to August Wilson, his idea of this play and Harold Loomis and how he fits in the world.
Oh, and I love that association with Loomis and luminous.
Nice.
I didn't realize it was originally titled Millhand's Lunch Bucket.
Yes.
That title comes from a North Carolina favorite son. Most listeners are familiar with Romare, depending on how you pronounce it, Bearden. This comes to us from the 80s. What was the 1980s African-American creative class scene? Was there a lot of cross-fertilization going on?
I think in looking at the picture, August Wilson saw the painting, and it goes back to voice. And in looking at the painting, one of the quotes that stand out to me is that he said, in looking at Bearden's work, it was the first time that he could see his image, the image of Black America, showcased on a canvas. And when you look at the image, there is a highlighted figure of a man that's sitting at a kitchen table, and he looks defeated, abandoned. There's a sense as if the world, the weight of the world has pressed him all the way down. And August Wilson saw that character in that picture, and he said, I wonder what is it about this gentleman that has him so despondent? What happened to him in this boarding house? And hence the character of Harold Loomis became the central figure of this play entitled Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And the interesting part about Loomis that I just found so exciting is in the play, Loomis is looking for his song. And he even says in Act Two, he's marching and he's talking about the dry bones. And he looks and he turns to the character Bynum and he says, they look just like you and me. They look just like you and me, and they're marching. And he's so excited about being able to see his image represented in a vision. So for me, that painting is so interesting because that was the impetus of how the story unfolded. That image, if images could talk, if the walls could talk, that image would tell the story of Joe Turner's Come and Gone.
To see how this man used pivotal moments in his life and influences, and they recur again and again throughout either the Pittsburgh Cycle or so many different plays, but in this case, blues, which was another huge impact on him. That's the title of a blues tune to begin with.
Yes. It's interesting because the character who sings the song, They Tell Me Joe Turner's Come and Gone, is the character of Bynum, who in the play is the character that August Wilson uses as a vehicle to heal. When you look at this time, 1911, these Black Americans that were dispersed, they're looking for a community, they're looking for opportunity, they're looking for a home, or looking for a voice. And August Wilson speaks about this idea of so much separation, being able to find a character that can bring about healing. So Bynum represents that character. And throughout the play, you hear him singing, They Tell Me Joe Turner's Come and Gone. Originally, it is a song that is place with a woman's voice, because during the time, the character itself was a man named Joe Turney. And Joe Turney actually was the brother of a governor in the time in Tennessee, Pete Turney. And Joe Turner had this job after slavery was abolished. They were trying to find a way of what to do with this free labor. So for me, the way I look at it is it went from working by ownership to work by punishment. So they would actually set up gambling scenarios where they would take out and put out dry bones, and they would have all these black men come and sit around and gamble. And then out of the blue, you would have a police officer that would show up and would arrest all these men for this idea of gambling and would force them to work for 5 and 6 and 7 years based on this idea of they've done something wrong. So for me, this was a way of really thinking about, in that time frame, finding ways to still keep that sense of slavery, but it was a way that was more accepted by the people of the time, that these are sinners. These are people that needs to, they're not using their freedom in a good way. And so here's what we need to do to keep the peace in the community. And this is what we need to do to make certain that we protect our sons and our daughters.
They told me Joe Turner's come and gone. Oh, Lordy. They told me Joe Turner's come and gone. Oh, Lordy. Got my man and gone. He come with 40 links of chain. Oh, Lordy. He come with 40 links of chain. Oh, Lordy.
And the song, when these men were gone, and they would go out and say, well, in the play, his name is Harold Loomis. So I imagine his wife saying, Harold, Harold, Loomis, Loomis. And then someone says, Joe Turner's come and gone. And then that's when the women would start to wail because they've lost their husbands, they've lost their fathers, they've lost their brothers. And you would hear them singing, they tell me Joe Turner's come and gone. Got my man and gone, 40 chains and gone. So this was really a way of wailing, a way of finding ways to, there's nothing else I can do and how can we find him? So these are families that are separated based on this idea of, to me, I refer to it as a modern day slavery, finding ways to go by that idea of work by ownership to work by punishment. And that's why some of these, the character of Harold Loomis is so despondent, because he was actually a deacon in a church trying to save these men in the script from gambling. And he gets caught up in this world being forced to work for something, for a crime that he didn't do. And of course, in this time frame, they didn't have any type of law system where you were really given the opportunity to tell your story, the opportunity to prove that you were innocent. Instead, you were captured and in many regards given this idea to work in chain gangs. So in the script, there's other songs that you'll hear that August Wilson has inserted in the script. Payday.
Ooh, well, I got a boy child in Texas. He ought to be by gone. Oh, go marching to the T-ball, oh, no. Find the same old thing. Ooh. Boy, I'll be so glad when payday comes. Oh, Captain, Captain, when payday comes.
And this is a song that they would sing while they were working on the chain gangs. So in the script, the character starts to sing it, and Harold Loomis, who was forced to work 7 years, he tenses up, and he says, well, why are you singing that? Because it's starting to bring back the memories of what he's trying to forget. So although he is freed physically, he's still in bondage mentally. And I think that is Joe Turner's come and gone. However, mentally, what do you do with these men? And if we could take it till today, if you find a way to to place someone in bondage, either if it's by isolation or if it's by this idea of systematic rejection. And then this person is freed and everyone is happy. Well, what do they do next? And how are they able to recover from these chains that are still metaphorically binding them in some regard? So August Wilson uses a great deal of music and blues throughout the play. And it's interesting because the play is set in 1911. But the music you hear that August Wilson himself has inserted in the script you'll hear can be set in the 1920s. And the reason why, for me in my research, that he's done that is that you couldn't find recordings of Black voices readily in 1911 or 1910 because those voices weren't valued. It wasn't something that you would take and put on an album or a record because no one wanted to hear that. These were slaves. They are people who we had to fight in order to have the idea of being equal. So there's not many recordings of any of the songs there. So even in the script, the songs that we use or reference are actually from a later time than what we find in the script. But it has such a contemporary voice with the characters there as well that it's done intentionally and it still works in the world of the play.
I'm all cast at Illinois Central, oh no, going to Kankakee.
Triad Stage, Artistic Associate, UNCG Resident Director, Professor, Acting Coach, Actress, Playwright, Dramaturg, and Storyteller, Tamira Islar. August Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone continues through April 26th with evening shows at 7:30 and 8 and weekend matinees at 2 in Acock Auditorium in Greensboro. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and on the second half of the show today, Bethany Chafin will take a few victory laps with North Carolina Writers Network director Ed Southern. Ed's just won a big award during the NCWN's 30th anniversary year, and we're here to give him his proper due. Before we take that leap for literature, however, we're going to celebrate a music festival that's just a few years shy of the 30-year milestone.
Pack a change of clothes and a pillow for the road for when you drift off.
From its humble beginnings, playing for a few hundred folks in the back of a flatbed pickup truck, to nearly 80,000 fans of traditional plus music and a team of more than 4,000 volunteers, Merlefest has emerged as one of this country's premier music festivals. It's an annual homecoming for musicians and music fans alike on the scenic Mountain View campus of Wilkes Community College in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. Merlefest was founded in 1988 in memory of the late Eddie Merle Watson, son of American music legend Doc Watson. Doc called Merlefest a celebration of traditional plus music, a unique mix of music based on the traditional, roots-oriented sounds of the Appalachian region, and it's expanded to include Americana, Cajun, country, blues, rock, and many other styles. This year, the four-day event will host nearly 120 bands performing on 13 stages. Festival director Ted Hageman says the annual festival has become the primary fundraiser for the Wilkes Community College Endowment Corporation, funding scholarships, capital projects, and other educational needs.
I spent my whole life talking to everyone that I was something else.
I'm wondering how you go about putting together a massive program like this and make it so engaging with regard to the variety of styles and such.
Well, a lot of it goes back to 28 years of experience when you do this. And I've only been here 15 years, but when you take 28 years of experience and you try to learn from that each year of how can we make this better, we survey our customers. We ask them what they are looking for and what they appreciate, what they like. And, you know, during the festival, a lot of times we'll ride around to different stages and we look at the crowds and we look at what people are really migrating toward. There's always a few bands or artists each year that seem to be attracting a larger crowd. So we look at that, and that's kind of how we go about determining how things go for the next year. But we do really pay a lot of attention to surveys. We look at what's going on in the musical world and what people seem to be gravitating toward. We work years in advance. We've already got probably a dozen offers out for 2016, and I already know of an offer out for 2017. So it's a process that takes, it's not something that, you know, you start on 3 months before and you're ready to go. it's a constant process, and we're already making plans for next year's festival right now as we speak.
Pack my bags and all my things and lift them all behind. Red light flashing, cross that river bridge, and I'm heading down to Caroline.
What sorts of things are key from the musician standpoint? I've spoken with many of them. They enjoy it. They come back year after year in many cases. What do you think has been the key to making them want to come back to Merlefest?
I think there's a couple of things. First of all, Doc Watson was one of the major influences of why the festival started and survived and is here today. And so many of the artists that have come through the years came because of Doc. They wanted to play with Doc. That was on their bucket list. But we also have asked several people, and I think it was Sam Bush, when we asked him about the festival and why he found it so important, he said, you know, it's kind of a summer camp for artists because we can come here and do things here that we can't do every day out on the road. Artists do walk around among the public here at the festival. They actually will sit down and play under a tent with a wannabe or with somebody that just has a love for music who has brought their guitar with them. It gives them an opportunity to get out and do things that they normally wouldn't do. It's also an opportunity for them to collaborate with someone that they hadn't planned on even seeing at the festival, and they meet, and maybe it's during lunch they're sitting there talking, and they say, well, you know, I've got a 3 o'clock set, come on over and play with us. And so they get to do the unique thing that they normally don't get to do. And that's a lot of times what makes the moments and the memories of Merlefest.
Tell you about a thing that's been passed down. Grandma taught baby girl how to shake 'em down.
You've been doing it for 15 years, Ted. What else in general we'll say about organizing a festival of this size have you... picked up along the way, or what do you, beyond the volunteers maybe, what's another thing that you value as a key to the success of the festival?
Well, you know, we always try each year to look at things during the festival and make notes of what we think would make the customer's experience better. We look at things like transportation, and, you know, one of the unique things about our festival is a person could come, they park for free, we have a free shuttle bus that takes them to the front gate. When they come in, they get a free program, and if they bring their kids, 12 and under, they get in for free, and they get to go to the little pickers area and do all types of crafts and inflatables and all that type thing for free. So that's very unique, and so what we try to do is always look for ways that we can tweak things to make it just as smooth as possible, because when somebody comes and pays to come to a music festival, they're really wanting to get away from the everyday grind, and they're wanting to be able to sit back and really enjoy the music and enjoy their experience. And we feel like we have to keep our eye on that target at all times to make sure that the music is quality and that the experience that they get here is like no other place they can go.
Where has your focus been in terms of that family-friendly aspect of the festival, and what are you doing to introduce young people to the music?
This goes back to the formation of the festival. One thing that Doc Watson asked was that it would be an alcohol-free event, and we have stayed true to that and will continue to do that. And I think that has a lot to do with the crowds and people feeling safe and feeling like a family atmosphere. People want to bring their kids into a good environment. So that's one of the things that we do. I've also heard people comment about most of the people that come to Merlefest are here for the music and not necessarily for the party. And so we put a lot of emphasis on that.
She was a waitress at the only joint in town. She had a reputation as a girl who'd been around. Down Main Street after midnight, brand new pack of six, a fresh one hanging from her lips, a beer between her legs. She'd ride down to the river and meet with all her friends. The road goes on forever, and the party never ends. Sonny was a loner, older than...
Say, Ted, what are some of your goals for the future of this great festival?
You know, somebody has asked me before, well, how big do you want to, you know, how many people do you want to bring? Our goal is not necessarily to see how big we can get, is to make sure that we maintain the quality, that we maintain our values. We do feel like we have a niche here. We're meeting a niche that maybe some other festivals are not meeting. And so we're going to continue down that trail of providing a quality event, great customer service, and above all, wonderful music. I mean, that's got to be where our focus is. And one of the reasons that we do want to stay on course on this, of course, is we want to continue to always remember the Watson family and what they have helped us do. And this was started to remember Doc's son Merle and now also Doc, but it's also the primary fundraiser for our community college. And the money that's generated from each festival goes to provide scholarships and capital projects and training and technology for our students. And so, you know, our primary goal there is we're helping to change lives. We're helping people get back to work or to find a new vocation. So that's where our focus is for the future.
As the festival director, Ted, and you've got the pocketbooks and the headaches and the coordinating and all the delegating. And what's in it for you? What do you enjoy most about your role as festival director?
I love to see it all come together during those 4 days. To see so many volunteers doing their jobs and coordinating things and working with a smile on their face, that's just the highlight of my year each year, is when we get to that point and we're seeing it all come together as a team. I love to see people come and enjoy themselves, and it's a good feeling to know that they truly feel like they're getting their money's worth and that they're enjoying the festival. And I love to see the benefits that come from the money that's raised when you find people that are wanting to get to work, and this may make a difference in whether they find a job and are trained to go out in the working world.
That's got to be really satisfying to see it working like a well-oiled machine.
Well, I'll be the first to say that this festival does not happen because of Ted Hageman. It happens because of all the people that get involved. My role is just to make sure that everybody's communicating and talking, and we do have a kind of a roadmap to follow, but those are the folks that make it happen.
Yeah, I've got bruises on my memory.
Festival director for Merlefest, Mr. Ted Hageman. Merlefest 2015 runs from Thursday, April 24th through Sunday the 26th on the gorgeous Wilkes Community College campus in Wilkesboro. For the complete lineup, visit our website at WFDD.org, where you'll see Avid Brothers, Dwight Yoakam, North Mississippi All-Stars, Steep Canyon Rangers, and Robert Earl Keen among the list of 117 bands performing the best of the best traditional plus music on the 13 different stages of Merlefest. It's kid-friendly, family fun, and the right place to be this weekend. And Triad Arts Weekend's the right place to be this very minute, because when we come back from the short break, he's navigated the North Carolina Writers Network through the choppy waters of the Great Recession, transitioned the organization from a brick-and-mortar company to a virtual organization, and grown it by 20% along the way. North Carolina Writers Network director and award-winning author Ed Southern shares his recipes for success with associate producer Bethany Chafin next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin. In 1985, the North Carolina literary landscape was ready for a statewide organization. Already, there was a group for published authors, and the North Carolina Poetry Society existed, but individuals decided it was time for an organization that would bring all of the state's writers together. Today, it's one of the nation's largest writers' networks. With just under 1,200 members, the network provides resources and opportunities to writers of all levels working within every genre. Executive Director Ed Southern stopped by WFDD to share how the network approaches its mission, how that mission has evolved over the years, and why exactly North Carolina is the writingest state. So you talk about providing something for everyone. It sounds like you all have brought that down into three things that you feel you can provide. You can provide encouragement in working towards excellence. Mm-hmm. You say that a lot of writers are searching for opportunities and they want to feel part of a community.
Yes.
Those are some of your guiding goals, it seems. Is that right?
They are. And, you know, we really began emphasizing those in the middle of the last decade, when a lot of the services that the network provided weren't as needed as they once were, now that we were well into the age of the internet. You know, whereas once the network had kept a library of resources, you know, listings of agents and publishers and editors and things like that. You know, when everyone can get on Google, you don't need to come to our library to find that. And we also saw a rise in local writing groups all over the state, which we're glad to see. We like to see anything that supports writers. Winston-Salem and Greensboro both have thriving writing clubs, as well as Burlington. And so we thought, well, what is it that the network can do? And we realized that we are uniquely positioned to provide those three things: excellence, opportunity, and community, to the extent that anyone is able to provide that. You know, at some point a writer has to reach out and grab it themselves. Those are three things that writers, most writers, are always going to need. They're always going to need the ability to hone their craft, to improve their work, to strive for excellence. They're always going to need opportunity, because as much as we might wish for it, generally agents and editors don't come beating down your door as soon as you finish your latest manuscript, you know, with blank checks in their hands. You know, you have to go out there and find the opportunities that are available, and you have to make the most of them once you've found them. And most writers need community. Writing can be a very lonely and isolating pursuit. You know, you sit alone at your desk or wherever it is that you do your work, and you live inside your own head for, you know, what can be months or even years, depending on what you're working on. And you have to break away from that. You need support. You need encouragement. And the benefit of a statewide writers group is that you never know where that encouragement, where that piece of advice, where that inspiration is going to come from. And so we give you a wide pool of authors, of writers to get to know. And who knows which one of the writers that you meet at one of our conferences or one of our workshops is going to be the one who's going to give you that little nudge, that little boost that you need to finish whatever you're working on, to find a good agent, to find a good publisher. Who knows?
Can you talk about community and the need for that, because writing can be solitary by nature, but also just the need for knowing that you're not alone in a changing landscape?
Yes.
I can't imagine how important that is for your members.
Very much so. You know, we get calls and emails all the time from people who have something that they want to produce, and they want to get it out there. They want to find an audience, and they really don't know how, because a lot of people grew up with this image that in itself was not always correct, even at the time, of you write the great American novel and you find an agent, and the agent finds a publisher, and next thing you know, you're at a launch party in a, you know, swanky New York loft holding a cocktail in your hand. And it doesn't happen like that anymore. I mean, I don't know that it ever happened like that, but it certainly doesn't anymore. I mean, there's a myriad of options out there, and trying to sort out what option is best for you, depending on your goals, can be daunting, and it can be frightening, because, you know, a lot of writers, they're afraid of making a mistake. They're afraid of, do I keep searching for an agent? Do I keep trying agents and publishers and going the traditional route? Do I self-publish? Do I just put this out electronically and not worry about a printed copy? And, you know, they're worried that they're going to make the wrong decision. I don't know that there is a wrong decision. It depends on what your goals are. And what we try to do at the network is make sure that people understand the ins and outs of that, so that you can decide, well, what do you really want to do? And what is really going to be best for you, so that you don't jump into something.
Well, I'm going to make you switch from the executive director cap to the writer cap, even though I know you wear them simultaneously. But as a writer, what's some of the best advice you've received through the network?
The best lesson, I'm going to call it a lesson, that I've received from the network and from being around the network, you know, wasn't advice that was said to me. It was the example that I have seen of how hard writers have to work and how the biggest stumbling block that I see writers trip over is not producing the best work that you can. I think most writers, well, I won't say most. I will say a lot of writers, and I was one of them, you know, when they come out of college or they, you know, whatever stage of life they've made the decision that they want to quote, be a writer. You have to have a certain amount of ego to make that decision in the first place. You know, you've got to feel like you, possibly against all available evidence, you've got to feel like you have something worth saying that other people are going to want to read. And you've got to have a certain amount of that arrogance to get you through the rejections and the disappointments that will come, that come to every writer. Too many writers allow themselves to get frustrated, feel like, you know, something about the process is out to get them, when it's really just a question of, are you really producing the best work that you can? Are you really telling the best story that you can? Sometimes the story that you have to tell is not a story that other people want to hear. And you have to accept that and move on and try to find another story that people do want to hear. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't write that first story that you have to tell. And I'm saying this from personal experience. Sometimes you have to get that out of your system. You have to, you know, maybe use that as practice and then move on to, you know, a story that perhaps is a little bit more compelling. I was emailed not long ago by a college senior who was asking for advice on being, you know, she wants to be a writer. And I told her, well, first of all, I said, I don't have a ton of advice to give because every writer approaches it differently, and they should. I'm always very wary of prescriptions for writing. You know, you in order to be a writer, you must do this. The only thing that you have to do in order to be a writer is to write. And if you want to be a good writer, to work really hard at it. But the one piece of advice that I did offer is, don't want to be a writer, want to write. Worry about the story. Worry about the poem, whatever genre it is that you choose to work in. Concentrate on that, and concentrate on the craft and the doing of it. Even now, I'm very reluctant to claim the identity of writer. If people ask me what I do, I don't know that I've ever given that as my answer, because I try to think of it more as an activity, something I do, and perhaps in the doing it becomes something that I am. But first and foremost is the writing itself. It's not me.
That's wonderful advice. Thank you.
Thank you. I've never done that in an interview before.
Why is North Carolina the writingest state?
I think a lot of it has to do, and of course this is revealing my bias, but I think a lot of it has to do with the state's past and the state's history. I think it was not that long ago that this state was very different from what it is now. It was a very rural state. It was a very poor state. And in a lot of ways, it was a very backwards state. I can say that because I'm from North Carolina on both sides of my family, going back for hundreds of years. So, and in the latter half of the 20th century, the state began a remarkable transformation into, you know, a more urban and suburban, you know, first an industrialized state, and now, you know, we're a leader in banking and finance and technology and biotechnology. I think about my grandparents, and it probably, the very notion of a Wake Forest biotech place would have been unfathomable to them. And so, you know, it's in a fairly short amount of time, the state's gone through some remarkable changes, and that produces a need to make sense of those changes on the one hand, and to record what's going away on the other. You know, you want to have some memory, some record of what went before and is no longer, as well as, you know, just try to put some sort of framework onto this very dynamic place that we're living.
Executive Director of the North Carolina Writers Network, Ed Southern. Ed is the author of three books, Voices of the American Revolution in the Carolinas, The Jamestown Adventure, and Parlous Angels. He's also the most recent recipient of the Ethel N. Fortner Writer and Community Award, given for ardent supporters of the arts in communities. The North Carolina Writers Network recently held their annual spring conference, and they anticipate their upcoming fall conference to be held in Asheville, where they'll celebrate their 30th anniversary. For more information on Ed Southern and the North Carolina Writers Network, visit our website at WFDD.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. Stay tuned, because after this short break, you'll hear from a great artist who's appearing at Merlefest.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. The halls of classic rockdom are filled with triumph and tragedy. What can often be considered a young man's game is a career that can take its toll physically and artistically. Among the bands that have ridden out the storms of stylistic changes and the unpredictable nature of life itself is the Marshall Tucker Band. For the past 43 years, and counting, the Marshall Tucker Band have journeyed tirelessly across the globe, playing their hits like Heard It in a Love Song, Fire on the Mountain, and Can't You See? They've also become a staple on the jam band circuit. With an energy that trumps many young bands playing today, my guest, Marshall Tucker Band lead singer and founding member Doug Gray, plays about 150 shows a year. And his favorite concerts are those that last 4 hours or more. Him and the boys will be playing at this year's Merlefest. He spoke with me from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Gonna take a freight train down at the station low. I don't care where it goes. Gonna climb a mountain, the highest mountain. I jump off, nobody gonna know. Can't you see? Audience comes to see the Marshall Tucker Band, what are they getting? They're getting something new. You said you play these really long sets. So what's changing night after night, and how are you keeping it fresh, not only for yourselves, but for audiences?
Well, you know, I'm 66 years old, so I've been around a ton. And I've been around music since I was 7 years old. And, you know, went a little tour in Vietnam, came back, started a band, started another band. Then me and Toy and Tommy and all got together and started this band. And then that band only lasted for 8 years, and that was the Marshall Tucker Band, the original Marshall Tucker Band. And so all of these guys that I have now that's dedicated, you know, these people come and go, and I get more and more excited every day. I mean, as I told you, I'll be with Red and Sony until I'm 72 years old, and then that won't stop, primarily because we keep putting out new, exciting material. That's the key to our success. And I really believe that, because people get so bored listening to the same song, even though they're exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm not talking about just anybody, just us as well. I mean, I listened to one of our old songs. I said, well, you know, well, we sure could have picked that up in a little different thing. Well, that's what we do when we're on stage. Marshall Tucker Band had been a lot before we ever got gold and platinum records hanging all over the walls and all that stuff. We're a band that plays live. And before we ever got any of those gold records, or before we started playing 300 dates a year or whatever, we played live, and people would always say, well, man, that's the best I've, you know, that's the most fun I've ever had. I ain't never
been with a woman. Well, it's definitely clear you still love it, and it's great you've been able to continue to do it in this way and are still having so much success. And, I mean, kudos to you.
Yeah, and we're fortunate, man. I'm gonna tell you, we're fortunate, because I listened to new bands. A new band opened for us the other night, and they were just so good. I had to just get that singer back out there to sing, you know, one of our old traditional songs with us. Because, you know what? Everybody knew that song. It's like, Can't You See?
Not many people have that kind of experience. You play these big shows, and you're known for your extended jams and bringing in other musicians and, you know, providing a great show for people. But what is it still like to have those songs like Can't You See and Heard It in a Love Song that are such a part now of American
rock history, and to be able to still play those and play those for audiences. I mean, that's not a feeling many people have ever had or will maybe ever have. What is that like?
You know what? It's like looking at a picture on the wall. You know? it's like looking at a picture on the wall. Heard it in a love song. Heard it in a love song.
Heard it in a love song. Can't be wrong.
Doug Gray of the Marshall Tucker Band. They're playing this year's Merlefest in Wilkesboro on Friday, April 24th at 6:45 p.m. For complete details on Merlefest 2015, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our executive producer is David Ford, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts on our website at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well at Triad Arts Speak. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.